This evening we launch a new series on the subject of prayer. I see this as lasting, 3 months or so. This is an area in which I suspect most of us need encouragement. I know that I do. I am hoping that we will be led by these times into an ever greater dependence on God in prayer. This series will not be geared toward getting you to pray more, however. That might sound like a terrible thing for a pastor to say. It's not geared toward that, okay? It's not focused on that. You know, that's not what I'm really trying to accomplish. If it does result in more prayer that is offered in humility and grace, wonderful. I'm all for that. But you need not fear that there will be some burden laid upon you in this matter. Many of us would be a little sheepish about the amount of time we spend in private prayer. But I will be leaving that matter between you and the Lord. In fact, there are a lot of areas of prayer that we will not be pursuing over these weeks. We will not be thinking much about praising God or confessing our sins to God or even thanking God as we go through the Thanksgiving season. The focus will be on petition, and specifically petition in the New Testament. That might be prayers on behalf of ourselves. We make petitions that way. Or it might be on behalf of another. We call that intercession. But we will consider scriptures that connect with asking God for what we want. I guess in that sense, I will be addressing the most common aspect of our prayers. Asking God for what we want. Petition seems to be what we do best. But perhaps we could be doing that more in line with God's word. When it comes to petition, what might be lacking on our part? Should we be more persistent with a given request? That might move us in the direction of more prayer if we come to that conclusion. Do we need a greater faith so as to achieve spectacular results? We'll be dealing with well-known, even classic passages in this series. Parables on prayer. The Lord's Prayer, as we call it. The prayers of Paul. But it might be that we will look at them differently than you have in the past, and therefore gain some unexpected and helpful answers to these questions that I've already posed. At this point, I want to make something clear. I think that you know that I do my own work, maybe to a fault, when I prepare my messages. But when someone has significantly affected my thinking on a passage, or in this case, a subject, I really like to let you know about that. And that is very much the case in regard to this particular series. It has been inspired and informed by the book, Knocking on Heaven's Door. Knocking on Heaven's Door by David Crump. Interesting last name, C-R-U-M-P. David Crump, he is a professor at Calvin College. Knocking on Heaven's Door. As would be true with most everyone, I do not agree with all of Dr. Crump's perspectives. But I found his book to be helpful in reevaluating some of the passages that we will be pondering during this series. So I'm telling you right now up front that I am reflecting a lot of his thinking, and that he spurred on a lot of the thinking that I've done, even if it doesn't really involve things that he had to say in his book. Okay? We begin tonight with an episode that took place well into Jesus' ministry. It followed immediately upon the transfiguration of Jesus. You probably know that was pretty well on down the line. We're at an interesting place in the book of Mark. We had some discussion about this in our leadership group. The author, Mark, here almost seems to restart his book at this point with the transfiguration. The disciples had been expecting a quick transition from Jesus' announcement of the kingdom and all the signs of the kingdom that were involved with that transition pretty quickly right into the commencement of the kingdom. All these miracles must mean that prosperity for Israel and reigning with the Messiah were just around the corner. But from the transfiguration time forward, Jesus instead emphasized suffering, both in regard to himself and his own mission. This is when he begins to talk very frequently about, hey, everyone, I'm going to be betrayed. I'm going to, be mistreated. I'm going to be handed over to the leaders of the Jews. I'm going to be crucified. I'm going to die. From this point on, he emphasizes more and more the humility that would be needed on the part of those who would serve God. In this context, we see a theology of petition develop as Jesus works with his followers. We always want to begin with Jesus and with his example and with his teaching, and we're going to do that here as we begin this series. So let's see what he tells us about prayer as he encounters a father's petition. What we will do is focus on the faith of this man who came to Jesus. We'll do that first. Then we're going to look at Jesus and his will, how that affects the situation. And finally, we'll look at the disciples and their lack of petition. The first point tonight is the irrelevance of the Father's faith. Well, that sounds provocative. What? The irrelevance of the Father's faith. Let's read the majority of these verses, and I will try to explain what I mean by that. Verses 14 through 24. When they came back to the disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and some scribes arguing with them. Immediately, when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed and began running up to greet him. And he asked them, "What are you discussing with them?" And one of the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son, possessed with a spirit which makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it slams him to the ground. He foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. I told your disciples to cast it out, and they could not do it." And he answered them and said, "O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me." They brought the boy to him. When he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into a convulsion, and falling to the ground, he began rolling around and foaming at the mouth. And he asked the father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. It has often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. And Jesus said to him, if you can, all things are possible to him who believes. Immediately the boy's father cried out and said, I do believe. Help my unbelief. The they in verse 14 is Jesus and his closest disciples, Peter, James, and John. They came back to the other disciples. They have descended from the Transfiguration Mount and now come upon a scene that has a history to it. A large crowd has gathered around the nine disciples who had remained behind. The mood is not collegial. There is an unpleasant exchange going on between the disciples and the teachers of the Jews. No doubt the scribes were mocking the disciples for the failure that we will address in our last point. The disciples could not cast out a demon. And the enemies of Jesus were going to make hay out of that as publicly as possible. Then the crowd sees Jesus approaching. We read that they were amazed to see him. My guess is that they were thinking, this is just too good to be true. They were going to be treated to a throwdown now. With Jesus entering this situation, you know, who knows how entertaining this could get. The crowd is always amazed at Jesus, is it not? Every gospel, all through him, as he's doing whatever he's doing, they're amazed. At the end of this whole event, we don't have it here in Mark, but the crowd was still amazed and marveling, according to Luke. They started out amazed, they ended up amazed. What we never read about the crowd is that they're sincerely believing Jesus. The crowd never does that. In fact, Jesus immediately tells his followers after this event that he will be delivered into the hands of men and be killed. We think of the words from John. He was not entrusting himself to them because he knew what was in man. That we are not to put any stock in the people surrounding the disciples here is made clear from Jesus' words in verse 19. Does that sound like a vote of confidence from Jesus over their amazement? They were part of an unbelieving generation. Luke adds, perverted, if unbelieving isn't enough for you. How's that for getting the crowd on your side? Hey, you unbelieving and perverted people. Jesus is incensed. He is grieved over this superficial display of interest in him. Wouldn't that have just gotten old? After 3 years of ministry, constant signs of his identity, Jesus is so tired of dealing with this willful ignorance. I tend to think that Jesus is not including his disciples in this rebuke, though he will have instruction for them later. But I do not believe he's including them in these words about an unbelieving and perverted generation. Jesus is speaking of the scribes. He's speaking of this crowd. And he is speaking specifically of the Father, I believe. Note the them as far as Jesus' audience in verses 16 and 19. The disciples are separate in verse 16. Okay, you know, what were you all saying to them? And the Father had been speaking on behalf of the crowd. He speaks up and he speaks on behalf of the crowd, and Jesus speaks to him. I believe he's very much included in this overall evaluation that Jesus gives of this generation. So what do we make of the Father? Our initial reaction to him is to be sympathetic, right? Sympathetic to this guy. He has a son with a terrible affliction. He's come to Jesus to seek healing. His disciples cannot do anything. The scribes get in on this situation for their own purposes. The Father's attempt to see what Jesus can do, it looks like it's being hijacked, and the whole situation is just falling into chaos. Then Jesus arrives and encourages his faltering faith. He's struggling with, you know, what Jesus might be able to do, but Jesus understands, doesn't he? I mean, he meets you where you are. The fact that he does heal the boy shows that the Father's heart was in the right place. Oh, he left this scene as a follower of Jesus with a strengthened faith. Well, that is one possible scenario, I suppose, but I highly doubt it. The Father is never separated from the rest of the crowd in any of these accounts. He never does show any faith in Jesus. He never receives any approval from Jesus. Rather, the opposite. He is immediately dropped from the narrative as soon as the boy is healed. I just cannot get excited about him. For all we know, he was actually part of a testing of Jesus here that was cooked up by the scribes. What might impress us is verse 24, right? I do believe. Help my unbelief. But let's trace this from verse 22. The Father had said, if you can do anything. Then help us. Jesus' response proves that this was the wrong approach to Jesus. If you can, what do you mean, if? Of course I can. The Father knows that he stepped in it. You know, things are going in the wrong direction. He has unintentionally revealed his heart with his words. He does not see Jesus as the Messiah. So he tries to recover with this cry, I do believe, help my unbelief. Tries to salvage this situation. And this has often been seen as an honest desire to believe. I'm kind of there, and just kind of help take me the rest of the way. It could even be seen as a humble thing that we could even approve of it. But I have great misgivings about whether that's the right way to see those words. First of all, saying I do believe does not mean that there is any true faith in the heart. The Gospel of John is full of people who were believing in Jesus for quite some time. In fact, they could even be called disciples, followers of him. And they deserted Jesus. And then there's how we interpret help my unbelief. Okay, that can have two meanings. It could be that he's asking for a stronger faith. Often that's what it's seen as. But it also could well be a demand for Jesus to heal and therefore prove that he is the Messiah. We need something more to really start to think about believing in who you really might be. Note the connection of the word help in verses 22 and 24. The idea could be, help us, and then we will be more inclined to believe in you. I'm afraid that given the overall context here, that is where the Father was coming from. Do this for us, and we'll consider, a little more carefully whether you might be this Messiah. I don't think that this father had faith. And yet Jesus granted the petition. The son was healed. So what is the lesson regarding the father? Is it that he was basically believing, and so Jesus responded to what faith there was here? I don't think so. I think that the lesson is that the presence or absence of faith in the father was irrelevant. Now, don't get me wrong. This man had a responsibility to believe in Jesus as the Messiah. And it would go well with him if he did. But the positive outcome of his petition had nothing to do with the status of his faith. We see Jesus healing thousands of people in the Gospels who had no faith. None at all. They just heard that a guy could heal them. And that sounded good. So what then is the key here as far as the granting of this petition of the Lord? Here we come to our second point, which is the relevance of Jesus' will. Here we focus on what Jesus says at the end of verse 23. All things are possible to him who believes. How many applications have we heard of that and similar verses in Scripture? All things are possible to him who believes. What was Jesus doing by saying that? It's important to decide. It's really important to decide what Jesus meant by that. because we will be encountering similar statements as we go through this series. And it's something that you hear just, you know, even out in the culture. Was that an invitation to the Father to believe, and then he would realize that what he wanted from Jesus was now possible? Is it an invitation to this man to believe? Is Jesus saying, if you don't believe, then your request is impossible? Is the teaching here for us that if we will believe in Jesus and what he can do, then the sky is the limit as far as success in our petitions? Oh, this can mean a lot of things. It's important to decide what it does mean. I'm going to give all of these questions that I've just asked a no answer. Not an invitation to believe. Not telling him that if he doesn't believe, Jesus can't do this. Not a teaching that if we believe in Jesus and what he can do, then the sky is the limit as far as always getting what we ask. I don't think that the faith of the Father or of anyone else surrounding Jesus was in view in this statement. Who is the him in this statement? I think it's Jesus. I think that Jesus is pointing to himself as the perfect believer for whom all things are possible. This is how the statement is related to Jesus' question. If you can, don't you understand who you're talking to? If you can do this, all of my petitions are answered positively. Because I always ask in accordance with the Father's will and with complete confidence in him. So why does Jesus heal this boy? Verses 25 through 27. Okay, this is right on the heels of help my unbelief. When Jesus saw that a crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You deaf and mute spirit, I command you, come out of him and do not enter him again." After crying out and throwing him into terrible convulsions, it came out. And the boy became so much like a corpse that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and raised him up, and he got up. Did you notice what spurred Jesus to grant this petition? We're expecting something like, and seeing the true faith that was rising up in this man. Jesus marveled and said, let it be done to you according to your belief. Your son is delivered. But the fact of the matter is much stranger. What the guy just said is ignored. When Jesus saw that people were running to find out what was going on, then he rebuked the spirit. Needless to say, there were many threads coming together in this healing. The Lord is always doing, you know, many different things in various lives. Jesus was compassionate toward the needs of people. I'm not emphasizing that tonight, but that's true, and that's always a part of this equation. He did not like to see people in bondage to the evil one. So from that standpoint, he was compassionate to deliver this boy. Also, he was here to show that he did have power over the spirits. Certainly did that. He was the breaking in of the coming kingdom for a time. He was showing who had all authority. That's true. That's happening. And he had a timetable for his mission that meant keeping many things as private as possible. And that's also going on here. But the bottom line here is that Jesus healed this boy because he willed it. This fit into the big picture of what the Father was doing through him. While God was accomplishing many other things through this, what mattered is what this said about Jesus as the Father's Son. He was just once again demonstrating who he was. Sort of like the Transfiguration. These are all just pieces of the same puzzle. This is my son. Listen to my son. Observe my son. See who he is. Follow him. Our perspective on this is aided by an incident earlier in Jesus' ministry, much earlier, actually. We can turn all the way back to Mark chapter 1 and look at verses 40 through 45. Mark 1, verses 40 through 45. And a leper came to Jesus, beseeching him and falling on his knees before him and saying, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Moved with compassion, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, "I am willing. Be cleansed." Immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. And he sternly warned him and immediately sent him away. And he said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded as a testimony to them." But he went out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread the news around to such an extent that Jesus could no longer publicly enter a city, but stayed out in unpopulated areas, and they were coming to him from everywhere. So we don't want to fall all over ourselves praising this leper either. No. He was immediately disobedient after being healed, as Jesus knew that he would be, I believe. But he was immediately disobedient, did exactly what he was told not to do. It could be that he was not actually savingly believing. I don't know. But I don't believe that it was his faith that caused him to be healed. I don't think Jesus healed him on the basis of his faith. Certainly not on the basis of any subsequent obedience. Jesus had compassion on this man, we read. I think that that's important again, certainly. But Jesus has compassion on people when he does not heal them. He's always compassionate whatever he decides is right to do. The leper nailed it, though, by saying, if you are willing, you can make me clean. And it's not if you can, it's if you're willing, I know you can. And Jesus confirmed that insight by saying, I am willing. That was the issue, always. Was he willing to do this for his own purposes, for the Father's purposes? That's the all-important issue. Miracles in the New Testament are not consistently connected to faith, nor are they even consistently connected to asking for them. It's connected to Jesus enacting his will as the one who is perfectly faithful to his Father. Well, we need to get to the relevance of the disciples' prayer, lack of prayer, as it turned out. Verses 28 and 29, when he came into the house, his disciples began questioning him privately, why could we not drive it out? And he said to them, this kind cannot come out by anything but prayer. I'll note one matter that connects with our last point before we focus in on the disciples. If this kind of spirit cannot come out by anything but prayer, then what did Jesus do? He prayed, right? He prayed to the Father. And the Father answered that prayer. It was his prayer to the Father that prevailed in this morass of unbelief and self-sufficiency. A lot to say about that, but let's consider what to make of the disciples in this incident. They're clearly separate here from the unbelieving generation, I believe. Jesus has chosen them out of the world. They receive the special instruction that others do not, the special explanations that others do not. We're familiar with this pattern, aren't we, in the Gospels? You know, we remember it from the parables when Jesus really got going with the parables and so forth. Jesus will do or say something that the larger public does not begin to understand. And we'll be getting to parables. I'm always tempted to launch into a little soliloquy on the parables, but we won't do that. But you know what happens there. The public has no clue, and then Jesus meets privately with his disciples and explains matters to them. That does not always seem to be of great benefit to the disciples, but it does mark them as true followers of Jesus, except, of course, in the case of Judas. But despite their basic belief, the disciples were not able to cast out this demon. Is that because they were unfamiliar with this whole exorcism thing? No, not at all. In fact, these guys were veterans of this kind of thing. They'd done it many times. Jesus had delegated the power to cast out spirits to them. They'd gone out all over doing it in his name. So this was not a matter of experience, nor was it a matter of effort. Now, I am sure that in the face of the taunts of the scribes, these nine men had given it their all in trying to make that spirit come out. They were obviously puzzled as to why they had failed. But from what Jesus says, this was a classic case of, you have not because you do not ask. the disciples had not prayed. They had not prayed. I take it that they had not prayed at all. Were they overconfident because of their past triumphs? They thought they could just, you know, speak to the demon. That would be that. You speak the name of Jesus, make a command. Did they believe that the power in these matters resided in them and there was no need to look beyond their abilities? I can't say exactly, you know, why there had been this failure. But it appears that it never occurred to them to petition the Father about this. Note that Jesus does not exhort them to a great faith in this. He does not suggest that, you know, an all-night prayer vigil would have really sufficed for this. You know, they just really needed to buckle down and have a, you know, a long season of prayer. He simply indicates that they needed to pray. Now, in Matthew's account of this event, Jesus does mention faith. And we're going to talk about the whole moving of mountains thing next week. Okay? So you can look forward to that. But what is interesting is that he says there in Matthew that all they needed was faith like what? A mustard seed. That's not a lot. That's like, if you don't have it as a mustard seed, it's almost really not there. Just the smallest amount of faith. And the lesson, I think, therefore, is it's not the amount of faith. It's not the magnitude of the effort in prayer that is the key. It's whether we turn to the Father about the matter at hand at all, believing that He can do what He wills to do. The issue here is a basic dependence on the Lord. I believe that's what Jesus was teaching. You guys were not in a dependent spirit when you approached this situation. In Matthew, we have a verse that is not in the earlier manuscripts that says that the key was prayer and fasting. And that might be what has stuck in your mind over the years when you thought about this spirit and how the disciples couldn't cast it out and that it took prayer and fasting to get that guy out of there. And man, you know, that's really getting in there and being committed. I mean, to fast, that's got to take some time, and you got to be praying all that time and fasting all that time. And, you know, maybe when you've really shown that you mean business, then you might be able to get this kind of a spirit out. I believe that verse in Matthew, which is in brackets, in our contemporary version, showing it's not in later manuscripts, I believe that was an attempt to import the prayer aspect from Mark, which is here in Mark, and then for good measure add fasting into the picture. Again, you can look at that Matthew situation, you can see it's in brackets, that it's not in the earliest manuscripts. To me, this smacks exactly of man's thinking in this kind of a situation. If you'll just commit yourself to that kind of sacrificial effort, then you will receive what you desire. we will see if that kind of an emphasis, that, you know, really get in there full bore, you know, with great zeal, just, you know, lots of persistent prayer and fasting. Let's just see as we go along if that is what we find in subsequent passages. I think you can understand I'm saying that I don't think that is the lesson to take away from this passage that we're looking at. Again, it's basic dependence on the Lord, and we need to conclude. Much more could be said, but we will have time to say it, I think, over the next 3 months. Although I'm sure there will still be things left unsaid at the end of that. Because we're just starting tonight to pursue the themes that have arisen here. Okay? And if you're kind of, hey, I want to be thinking about this and pondering some of these things that have been brought up, that's good. That's what I want. Is success in petition tied to how committed you are to it? Is it tied to the size of your faith? God grants petitions where the faith is small or even completely lacking. He withholds from believers, even his closest followers, when they do not ask. When they don't seek him at all. So this is going to be a more mysterious journey than we might have thought at first. What we can expect is that the operative principle in petition is going to be whatever glorifies a free and sovereign God. What we can expect is that we will be pointed to Christ as the perfectly believing petitioner. This is certainly going to be about turning away from self-sufficiency and putting matters in God's hands. May God grow our sense of dependence on him as we continue to learn together from here on. Lord, whether we need to pray more often, and that might well be true, whether we need to pray more fervently, we certainly need to seek you in our spiritual challenges. It is to our shame that there are important matters in which we do not seek you at all. But tonight and every night, we are going to ultimately rest in the petitions of the perfect believer. And we do that in his name. Amen.